well in your beds.
Because if this thing comes true, there ain't gonna be any more.
It's an elevator. Somebody sent those deads up here to get us. Now, there's no controls inside, but there's maintenance overrides in there.
I was wrong. We were so wrong. We must leave.
Hello. Welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your hosts from the state of New Hampshire in the US of A, and with me in the state of Massachusetts.
Hey, everyone. This is Abe here.
Abe, how's it going, sir?
I'm doing good.
Excellent. And in the state of Missouri, is it?
Last time I checked, St. Louis is in Missouri. Yes. This is Kevin from west of Missouri, west of St. Louis. Welcome to the next segment.
Very good. And in the state of Virginia?
Hey, everyone. This is Barrett.
All right, Barrett, how's it going?
It's going great.
Excellent. And it's a little different. Who is Kevin and who is Barrett, you ask? For listeners who are new to the podcast, every 3 months now we just started a book episode where we discuss a genre book. So that would be horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse, and cult novels, things of that nature. And so we have a lineup of myself and Abe, and then Kevin Letts, who people may know from various emails, as well as the Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, and Barrett Heisner, who people may know from the Dark Discussion Podcast Facebook group, as well as our prior episode. This is the second. But for folks who are listeners to the podcast may know Barrett and Kevin also from the first episode of the book and the book episode where we discussed Stephen King's novel Pet Sematary, which was appropriate since there was a remake film that just came out earlier in the year that got mixed to positive reviews, depending on your perspective and whether or not you care if it follows the source material. For folks who are curious where you can find us on the internet, you can find us wherever podcasts are found. So Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, Podbean, Overcast, et cetera, iHeartRadio, we just added. But also you can find us at darkdiscussions.com where all the episodes are available to listen to. And also you can join us on Patreon where for every $5 that you donate to the podcast, you get to choose one film monthly for us to record. And what happens is for example, if you have $15 that you donate to the podcast to help for the cost that the podcast costs all of us, especially me with the fee to GoDaddy and all that, what happens is you can choose three films. So you can choose Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, and Halloween, or you could just choose Friday the 13th three times. And then what happens is they go into a spreadsheet, and then after the quarter is over, we randomly pick with a number generator one of the Patreon requests, and we have done a number of them recently, and we're going to pick a new one shortly. So get your Patreon in, where you can go to darkdiscussion.com and there's a link right to Patreon.
Also, you can, if you sacrifice a goat, you can increase your odds.
That's true. Also, darkdiscussions@AOL.com is the email. So if you want to email us and give us your opinion, feedback, discuss films that you've seen, suggestions, anything you want. And if it is an email that is not just suggestions, we will read it on the podcast. So that's pretty much it. Since we don't have Barrett and Kevin on except every quarter, at the end we'll ask you guys if you guys have played any video games or seen any films or read any other books that may be interesting to folks who listen to this podcast. But before we get into all that, I guess we can talk about our topic tonight. So, hey, what are we going to discuss tonight? What's this book in the book in the book 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 tonight?
All righty, for this book in the book 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 topic, it is another Stephen King novel. This time, we will be talking about Salem's Lot.
That's right. Salem's Lot is a 1975 horror novel by Stephen King, second novel that he wrote. It has been adapted at least twice in as a miniseries, both times. The first one was in the late 70s, directed by the late and great Toby Hooper. The second one was actually starred larger, or I guess, well, not necessarily true, just, but not a larger cast, but a bigger name as the lead, and that would be Rob Lowe, though the Toby Hooper starred one of the greatest actors of Hollywood's era, which was James Mason, as a supporting role. But besides that, we're really just going to try to focus on the book itself, because both of the movies, we could say, have changes that make it a little different, and we're here trying to do book in the book in a book book book. So let's start with you, Kevin. How did you hear about Salem's Lot, and what was your thoughts of it, and when was the first time you read it, and so on and so forth?
Okay, I first heard of Salem's Lot because I watched the miniseries back in the 70s, and I don't even know if I was 10 years old yet. And so naturally it freaked me out, but I was also utterly fascinated by it. And then, you know, I would watch it from time to time, and then the newer miniseries came out. And then, so eventually I bought both. I bought the 70s miniseries on Blu-ray and the more recent one, I think it was in 2003, maybe, on DVD. And then around that time, I read the book. I actually read the book, not listened to it on audio. I remember talking to Eric Webster about it, Dark Discussions co-host, back in high school, because I think he was either high school or middle high school. He was reading it, so I was talking to him about it. And I was just fascinated by it. And then I finally read it. And then I would just listen to the audio. Like, I would borrow it from the library. And then even on YouTube, I listened to a couple BBC audio dramas of it. I've just been fascinated with this book, with this story. And I would honestly say, if it weren't for Dracula, I would say this would be the quintessential vampire book.
All right, very good. Barrett, same questions. How did you first hear about it? When was the first time you read it? And what did you think?
I first read it in the 80s. I can't remember exactly when. Kind of mix up a little bit of the books at that point. I loved the book. When I read it, I've read it several times since then. I think it is definitely one of the best vampire books written. I also kind of, it's almost a haunted house story too, to me, kind of mixes those things together. So that's about it.
All right. Abe.
Well, I actually heard about it after I saw the miniseries. I knew it was based off a book, but I never read it until recently because I had started reading the novel, but I had to put it down for a bit because I had other stories I was trying to read and stuff, and you know, things in life just kind of pop up, and so it kind of hung on the shelf for a while. But after we did Pet Sematary, we decided this would be our next topic. I got right to back to reading it. It's definitely one of King's strongest. I definitely think it's, you know, I definitely agree that alongside Dracula, it's one the most well-known and probably one of the best vampire stories. And it's definitely just got a real good pace into it. But at the same time, kind of a slow burn to it. But it just really builds up the suspense and the mystery and everything like that. And it does this really well while also juggling an ensemble cast of, you know, varying degree of important characters, some lesser and more so. And it's going to be interesting to see how we dissect it tonight.
I mean, can I say, you talk about it being a slow burn. It may be a slow burn, but it's not a dull slow burn.
No, it's not.
Yeah, for me, I actually heard about it same way Kevin Letts heard about it, which was my father mentioned that a scary vampire miniseries was coming on the TV. Stephen King was already somewhat of a name. And basically what happened is I watched the miniseries when it came out in the 70s. And obviously, yeah, it was pretty impressive. Definitely. Probably a PG-13 film, even though it was on TV. I don't know how they got away with it. But yeah, I then read the novel in the 80s as well. I think it was the second novel I read after Pet Sematary by Stephen King. So that would have been in the early 80s. I do have a cute story where it was my mother's 50th birthday in the 1986, and we had all the extended family over. And it was in the afternoon, and some channel was replaying the miniseries on TV, and I had it on in the background, and my little Catholic French aunt, great aunt, was horrified at the show, and my mother forced me to shut it off because, yeah, she was like really, really Catholic to the point where she thought it was like something evil on TV. Yeah, I actually love the novel. I read it a couple of times, and it's a pretty solid novel. There's a couple of times that there's a suspension of disbelief I noticed during my rereading of it, where the Glick mother and that whole scene, even though it was an awesome scene. It's difficult to believe that anybody would believe in supernatural until they actually see it firsthand versus taking the word of someone they know just recently. So we'll get into some of that. But generally, the novels, yeah, it's one of my favorite Stephen King novels. And I don't know if it's one of the greatest vampire novels, because there's been a lot of vampire novels that I've read that a really solid that no one's heard of because the authors just don't have the name recognition of Stephen King. But
well, it's certainly better than the Eclipse series.
but it's a solid enough and probably is one of the better vampire novels of all time.
I just want to interject real quick. I feel very deprived because I didn't get to see the miniseries when it came out. I didn't see that until the late 90s, well after I had read the book.
So. I didn't even know it was by Toby Hooper until the 90s, to be honest, which was interesting.
Actually, I think I might have seen it in the early 80s instead, because I remember I think I was in third grade when I first saw it.
I first saw it when it was because I focused. Had a VHS tape, copy of it, and you know that's how I first saw it, and then kind of heard about both it and the and the novel as well.
Kevin, I have a quick question for you. All right, so I guess I'm the only one that actually saw it live when it was first released, or its debut, I should say. Kevin, I have a question for you. The Eclipse and all those novels, I have not read them. Have you read them so you can honestly say they suck, or are you just assuming they suck because of what you've heard from other people?
I saw the movie.
I have read them, and I've seen the movies. I don't think they suck as much as some people say. They're not anything like Stephen King, though. I mean, very...
I'm also just giving you grief, Phil.
Well, no. I mean, I am not a huge fan of I've never read the books, and I only liked the last movie, really. But I do love her other book, The Host. That's a solid novel. Obviously, yeah. I mean, those are teenage. I mean, they're young adult, right? They're considered young adult novels, so it's a little different. Anyway,
it's hard to compare. Yeah,
it's definitely harder to compare. All right, so we can discuss pretty much anything and everything about the novel. We're going to discuss the scenes and stuff. We're going to dissect it and whatnot. Obviously, we're throwing up a spoiler alert. However, I mean, we're talking about a novel that's over 43 years old now. I mean, which is insane when you think about it. So I'm not too worried about spoiling it, even if we didn't throw out a spoiler alert. So who wants to start?
I guess what we'll just go on what I mentioned about how this is a slow burn, but yes, it's not a boring slow burn. And one of the things I also mentioned was that it has a pretty big cast. Before we had started, I web a link to a long list of characters. This is quite some cast. Some of them are just people who are being mentioned, but it still kind of shows how well King managed to juggle all these individuals to tell a story basically about an infection of vampires and spreading throughout the town. There are some key players, but it's really interesting to show this kind of how everybody is affected by or infected by what transpires here.
Now, one of the most interesting things and most skillful things he's able to do is make you feel like it's a real town.
Exactly.
Basically, you could argue that this is a ensemble cast with a handful of leads. There is a lead character and a couple others that are close to being leads, but it is an ensemble cast. It's probably the reason why I like the novel a lot, because I'm a big fan of Michael Crichton novels, and he's very apt to do this as well, where it's a very large ensemble cast. And you're right. Barrett, where it makes the character of the town its own character, right? I mean, it's...
Yeah. Well, the most trickiest thing to do when you're telling a story is sometimes trying to give life to your setting. Unless you use some places that already exist, but even then, you still have to work to kind of make the favorite place feel like it's living, breathing environment, not just a backdrop. Because during scenes, King will describe areas, buildings, whether it's a park or the Marston House itself and stuff, and really kind of give a sense of it. You could actually be standing right in the middle of it and feel it just slowly, not just breathing, but slowly dying as the story continues.
I wanted to mention as well, so I agree that it's a slow burn, but it's a different type of slow burn book, because at a certain point, it's like it falls off a cliff and speeds towards the end, and you feel it when you get there.
Also, Barrett, it's I don't know if a slow burn is an appropriate term either, because since it's an ensemble cast, you have each chapter is almost like a set piece. So in each chapter, as a result, it's either a character development moment or a thriller / action type moment. So it's a little different than, say, like Pet Sematary, which you could argue was a slow burn, because that just followed a handful of characters and didn't have many switches by chapter to chapter to different characters. Here, you could have an exciting moment happen, whether it's something as like a fear in the town to someone setting up shop that is a with a lot of curiosities in it, to actually a vampire killing somebody or one of his helpers killing somebody. So it's really more set pieces rather than a slow burn, I feel. But I don't know how. What about you, Kev? What do you think on that comment, since I haven't heard from you recently?
No, I mean, I get what you're saying. It's almost like it's a slow burn with flare-ups.
Oh, yeah, right. Well, right. And I guess that's a semantic. You're saying flare-up. I'm saying set piece. But
well, yeah. I mean, I'm sorry. It's just, for example, you have, okay, this is a nice town. Something's kind of off. Okay, a dog dies. Oh, no, that's not good, but, you know, who knows what happened. And not too long after that, you know, a child disappears, and while everybody's searching, you hear, you know, talking about, you hear Straker's voice talking about, you know, his offering, you know, it's like his prayer to his unholy father type of thing, saying, you know, here's blood, and here's, you know, desecrated blood and all that sort of thing. You're like, wow.
It's an escalation of things.
Yes, it is. You know, and it also, but I mean, like you were mentioning earlier, it really does feel like it's a small town. I mean, you can almost picture it in your head.
Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I don't know generally how big the town is in a sense. I mean, for example, a lot of New England towns, where I lived, we have 80 to 90,000 mini cities to a town where I live, which is about 9,000 people, and to a town next to me, which has 2,000 people. So, and then, you know, I think it's similar to that, where this is probably one of those 2,000 to 7,000 people towns, I guess. And there's a lot of bigger towns nearby, because that's kind of, you know, because you drive away to go to the hospital, or you drive away to go to the funeral parlor, or you go to another town for whatever. But it's definitely not a huge town. So yeah, it's definitely a small New England ruralish town.
Yeah, I mean, most people leave the town just to go to work.
Yeah,
right. But it's not more. It's not like a farming community town. It's just like this rural town that people live in that still has shops and stuff. Don't get me wrong, but it's not the general suburb of a city.
Yeah, well,
right, right.
You know, it's a place that feels always at a standstill, which is why, you know, people always try and find a way to leave it and for the city or something bigger. Like the character Susan Norton, who's trying to find her own independence because she kind of feels isolated and kind of a motionless life because, you know, she's still with her parents. She's still trying to make her own, have her own identity as an artist. And she, you know, one of the things she's trying to do is prepare to leave.
Well, and that's interesting you say that, because you could argue, no disrespect to Maine, that Maine's one of those type of states that a lot of younger folk go to college somewhere else and they never come back type of thing. And even Stephen King said it in one of his speeches, commencement speeches for the University of Maine, where he said once that to the students that Orono, which is I think the name of the town that the university's in, isn't a town that you're going to stay in, and you shouldn't stay in. You should, because you got a degree to do something that may not be in Maine, and so you may have to go elsewhere. So yeah, you're right. There's a lot of younger folk like Susan Norton that would probably want to get out of this town, and not because it's a bad place to live necessarily. Even though Stephen King tries to show the rot of gossipy and all that crap that you would see in a small town, but more because there's not much opportunity to follow dreams in a town like this, unless your dreams are directly related to the going-ons in the town itself.
Yeah, it's definitely a thing where you know, the appearance of Stryker and the rumors of his partner, Kurt Barlow, moving into town, especially even the author Ben Mears creates a stir alone.
Yeah, because they're strangers. So yeah, let's talk about that at the beginning. So the beginning of the book, Ben Mears is this semi successful author that grew up partly, wasn't born in the town necessarily, but grew up in the town before moving out, and he has come back to try to jumpstart his career by writing a novel about this old house called the Marston House that is up on the hill in the town. And he, when he comes back, people look at him as an outsider, even if he happens to have some roots in the town. And then there's two other folks that move into the town as well, two older gentlemen named Barlow and Stryker, who set up a shop downtown for, I guess,
antiques.
Yeah, antiques. That's what it is. Yeah, and that makes sense. You say, you know, I mean, that's like antiques. Like that's like opening up a candles store like 20 years ago. Now you find candle stores everywhere. An antique shop in a town like this makes sense because, even though it's not necessarily a tourist town, a lot of folks from New York and other areas would come to a town like Jerusalem's Lot, which is the name of the town, to maybe see, for example, the autumn leaves changing, or to do hiking, or to do winter or summer sporting things. So,
well, there are people, sorry to interrupt, but I mean, there are people that will go, I mean, they it's called antiquing. Well, they will go from small town to small town and look in their, you know, small antique shops just to see if they can find a really good deal.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, sure. But the thing that makes it a curiosity here is why would these two, at least one of them, Stryker, people get to meet while Barlow is out of town, or on a buying mission,
a buying trip in New York City.
Yeah. Why would two gentlemen who are this, I guess, not prestigious, but aware of such things as fancy antiques want to just show up in the middle of nowhere, Maine, to do so? I mean, I can see some people questioning that, but for example, I used to date a girl from Iowa, that lived in a small town in Iowa, and out of the blue, a couple of Chinese people moved in and opened up a Chinese restaurant, and they made a fortune. You know, everybody, this is the only Chinese restaurant in the town. And so a lot of times people will come to these middle of nowhere places and open up something different because it could become successful because they are the only people that are doing it. And so if these guys came here, even though it seems weird, why would they come here instead of stay, you know, Boston or Providence or something? It makes kind of sense because they're not interested in the riffraff or the hustle and bustle. At least that's what it seems, or what they claim.
Yeah, I mean, somebody actually asked Stryker, you know, why the heck are you coming here? And he pretty much just said, look, we're retiring. This, you know, this is, we have a nest egg, and we just figured we'll just open this shop as something to do while we're retired.
Yeah, it just kind of to take up the rest of their days, and you know it's just kind of like what sounds like a normal thing, but for a little town where almost nothing happens, it ends up being this big almost event. A bunch of the women in the town actually start visiting the antique shop and talking to Stryker and stuff like that. It becomes this really interesting, funny thing when you think of how, in comparison, if it occurred in a big city, no one would bat an eye.
Right. Exactly. And being different, Stryker at least, even the constable or sheriff, or they call it constable in the novel, which is probably archaic, but not at the time that the novel was written.
Well, maybe he, just because it was such a small town that they couldn't, you know, really wasn't a sheriff or whatever.
But yeah, he even questions whether or not Straker and Barlow, if they're here to retire and they're unmarried, are they, for example, part of the LGBTQ community? And so he even is curious about that. So they stick out like a sore thumb for a number of reasons. But as Abe mentioned, it's exciting for the town folk because the town folk see something new, something exciting to do, and something, I guess, curious. Either way, Ben Mears, who's the author guy, he comes around and asks questions and, you know, whatever goes into the stores. They have a flop house in the town, boarding house, yeah. And so he gets a room there because obviously a town like this isn't going to have a hotel necessarily. And people begin to know who he is, if not him, some of his family. Because I think it was his aunt or his uncle that lived in the town, and he used to go there during the summers or something and stay there for the entire summer and whatnot. And so they know his family, even though they may not know who he is. All right, so I guess we could talk about either plots, points, like what happened, specific scenes, or we can talk about other characters and who they are, if you want. Which way do you guys want to go?
Well, what's interesting is that even though there are some leads, the time we spend with them is kind of nicely distributed through the pages. Because we spend some time with, we spend some plenty of time with them, but they don't feel overly focused on in a way. Like, no one feels like they're at the center of everything. They feel like just parts of a major event that they get caught up in.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Ben Mears is the central main character, at least the main character, he is not at the center of everything. He is just an individual who came to this town and get caught up in it's happening.
Right. So we mentioned Susan Mears. Susan Mears comes from
Susan Norton.
That's right. I'm sorry. Ben Mears is the author. Susan Norton comes from a strong middle class to upper middle class family.
Wants to be an artist.
Yeah, wants to be an artist. So she, you know, early 20s type of person.
I thought she was an artist and was looking at an ad campaign or working for an ad company in like New York or something like that.
Well, she applied there.
That was the job that she was going to take.
Okay.
Basically, she was going for an interview to New York City for the job.
Right.
So what we'll say, let's start over from here. So Susan Norton happens to, you know, be in the town, and she wants to move to Boston or New York or some other city what did you say, Barrett? You said like an artist or something?
Yeah, she's an artist, and I think that's what she does in town is sells her artwork.
Yes.
And she makes money doing that. And then she wants to go to New York, and she's applying at an advertising firm as an artist.
Yeah, she essentially wants to do what my wife does. She's my wife's a graphic artist and designer.
Gotcha. So what happens is that she's reading a book in the park, and Ben Mears happens to stumble upon her, and they become kind
of... They kind of hit it off because it turns out she was reading one of his books, and they started going on some small dates and stuff like that. But Susan's mother doesn't approve of Ben because of the rumors running what happened with his wife, who was killed in an accident, and also because she is more supportive of of a fellow named Floyd, who Sousa had broke off with some time beforehand.
Right, yeah. So basically, Ben Mayes has a history where he was married once, and he's a widower, because his wife died in a motorcycle accident where he was the driver. And so there's some scandal about that, even though I mean, motorcycle accidents and deaths are unfortunately very common. So I don't know if there should be any scandal when that happens, because those...
Well, they have, like, gossiping about him like he had been drunk or things like that. And that's not the case.
Right.
They thought he was... I mean, yeah, they were wondering if he was drunk because he had a breathalyzer test. And they said, well, he gave him a breathalyzer test. And Susan's like, Mom, they give everybody a breathalyzer test. It wasn't, you know, that he was drunk. And not only that, but he also wasn't really even injured.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it just depends on how you land, especially from a motorcycle. And it's also odd, too, because this Floyd guy, I think he's a townie. And for whatever reason, she likes this Floyd guy, the mother. But again, it may be also part of her not wanting to lose her daughter, because Floyd's a townie. She obviously, if Susan basically wants to break the umbilical cord, figurative umbilical cord, and get out type of thing, because she's living with her mother and father now and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the mother becomes overbearing and just paranoid. The character seems to come off as untrusting of anyone outside of the town.
Well, right. And unfortunately for her, they both have a strong connection almost immediately. They both think about it as being a very strong connection.
What do you mean? Who are the they? Who are
Susan they? And Ben, both. You get their thoughts in the book, and they both have this feeling that it's just, you know, that other person is someone that they want to be with immediately.
Sure. Yep. So we meet Susan, and she becomes an important character because she hooks up with the lead character. And then, as Abe mentioned, you know, it's an ensemble cast, and then we learn about other people, including, at least early in the book, we learn about a group of children, Danny and Ralphie Glick and Mark Petrie. Basically, Mark Petrie is from a family that's, I guess, newer in the town.
Yeah, they moved in some time ago, much before Ben had arrived. Because they mentioned that how he there's a scene establishing Mark where he gets to a fight with a bully who targets him because he's new in town.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and speaking of Mark is, I guess, may have been an oddball back in the 70s when the novel was written, because he's into genre type stuff like horror books and comics and all that, even though a lot of people liked that. If you were one of those people, you were considered, quote unquote, a dork. Now all that stuff is mainstream. So he's probably 40 years before his time. But he's basically like anybody who would listen to this podcast today. So that's his hobbies. He's also into art and theater and things like that. He does, his parents are so-so about his hobbies, but they don't see any true harm in it, so they don't really bother him too much, but they don't participate in the hobby. So it's not like they're into horror films and stuff like he is. And then the Glick boys, one's old, one's Danny is Mark's age, and Ralphie is a couple years younger. They live not too far away through like a forest to the onto the other side of the forest is another neighborhood, and they are friends with Mark, and their family's been in the town a little longer, but based off of some things we hear later, in the novel. I'm not sure how long, because, for example, when there's a passing in the Glick family, since we're in spoiler territory, it doesn't matter. When the whole family basically croaks, their bodies are sent to a Jewish mortuary or funeral parlor, because the last name Glick is generally known as a Jewish name, and yet they're Catholics. And so I'm not even sure if they've been in the town long enough for people to know much about them either. But either way, that was a either way, both of those families have become important to the novel. And later on, we learn about other characters of note, which we'll talk about in a bit. Matt Burke, a teacher, the Catholic priest, Callahan, and then the constable, Parkins Gillespie, and then a school teacher named Matt Burke. And then, of course, there's a bunch of supporting characters. All right, so what do you guys want to talk about?
Well, one thing we had talked about was how there is a nice escalation of events, some almost like foretelling signs of the vampire's arrival, and just how the defenses of the town are slowly broken down. A town that really nothing happens in is slowly encroached by strangers moving in, a townsman's dog being murdered and impaled on the cemetery fences. There's the Marston house, which has a dark history of a murder suicide that had taken place in there, and now some of the strangers are moving in there, and it's just slowly just kind of horrible little things going on here.
You get this sense of it being a haunted house, and how could anybody move in there? And
yeah. I think it was Ben Mears who said it was a monument to evil.
Well, let's talk about the house, because we haven't talked about because that's probably even more important than the vampires, because this book, even though it's about vampires, I think it's, and Kevin will appreciate this, I think it's more about Satan and Lucifer and evil in general.
And how evil can inhabit a place and draw evil to it.
Yeah, and Kevin, I know you always talk about how there's a lot of Cthulhu in some of the short stories that are related to this novel, but as Barrett just mentioned, and Ben Mears says a few times in the book, can a place be inherently evil as say, some people can be?
Well, I mean, he does say that, you know, the house drew... you know, draws evil. You know, it's probably, he does say that, you know, it says, can a place be evil? And it's probably, I mean, obviously what happened was, is that, the Marstons built it and they were very evil, and they kind of just, their evil permeated the walls and everything. And the evil that they brought in just kind of stuck with the house.
Yeah. It attracts evil people.
It attracts evil people and all that sort of thing. And of course, that's when Susan says, well, it attracted you, didn't it? And, you know, he's like, cause Ben Mears, I guess we won't get into that part yet, but Ben Mears had his own experience at this place, you know, and that's really what brought him back to Salem's Lot when he wanted to write that book. Was he wanted to write the book on the Marston house, you know, and that's what drew him. And it was partially to kickstart it, but I think it was also him wanting to fight off his own personal demons or something like that. And that's why he wanted to write the book.
Yeah. Because what happened was, years ago when he was young, he used to play with some of the local kids, and they would dare each other to do certain things. And one of these dares was someone had to go into the Marston house, take an item from it, and bring it back as a way to get into like a group or something like that. And Ben goes in there, but he finds something, but he decides to go deeper into it. However, that was the very same day that I think it was Hubie Marston, the name of the owner was.
No. What happened was is that Well, first of all,
Floyd He saw a ghost.
Yeah.
No. Yes. Actually,
Floyd Tibbetts, the guy he was contending for Susan's affections, was one of his friends. You know, but that's just kind of an interesting aside. But he went in to the house and it's like, okay, steal something. So we essentially stole a snow globe.
Yeah. And he
said, well, I'm going to really prove it, you know, because he was just in the bottom floor. So he went up to the top floor.
Yes.
He went into the bedroom and, you know, where Hubie Marston hung himself, you know, years and years and years ago. And he saw Hubie Marston there, and he says, you know, look, I don't know if it was a ghost, I don't know if it was my imagination just running with me, but it freaked him out, and he ran out of the house.
It haunted him.
Right, it haunted him. So.
Let's talk about who the Marstons are. So basically, there's this Yankee-type family, or maybe they anglicized the name, but basically, this guy Hubie Marston, his wife, basically became bootleggers in Boston, and were part of the Irish mob. Basically, though there was an Italian and Jewish mob, but Boston is well known for our Irish mob, Whitey Bulger, and so on and so forth. And basically, he moved up to Maine. And they killed themselves, murder suicide, as mentioned. Built a nice mansion up there, and then murder suicide. And the problem was is that obviously if they're into the mob and all the other stuff, you figure they're not good people anyway. And then there was also rumors that
Hubie Marston was also into satanic rituals and stuff.
Right, that's what I was about to say. Right. So there was also rumors that they were Satanists.
Yeah, I mean, there were rumors that, like, after they moved in, a couple children, I think young boys, disappeared, you know, and they never found them, or at least they never found all of them. And, I mean, Hubie Marston was also thought to be not just a alcohol runner, but also an assassin.
Right.
You know, they thought he was they figured out, you know, he was an assassin. They could never prove it, but they figured he was an assassin. And then it got to one point where, you know.
When you say assassin, I guess the term would be
a hitman.
Yes. A hitman. Yeah. Okay, he was a hitman for the mob.
Right.
You know, but they never proved it. And then so he just retired. But he was into Satanism. And so was his wife. I mean, his wife was into it just as much. And in the end, you know, he kills her. And I mean, later on in the book, you realize that, you know, she wanted it. She wanted him to shoot her, which I'm like, okay, fine. What? Why? And then he does himself in. But before he does, he sets up the rifle. Well, it's interesting. 1 minute, it sounds like he said, you know, they mentioned 30-06. And then later on, they talk about a shotgun. Well, those are two guns. A shotgun does not shoot a 30-06, but I digress.
No, completely different. 30-06 is probably the most powerful hunting rifle, and then obviously a shotgun is...
That compared to it, well, I'm not going to get into that one, but the thing is he takes the gun and he ties it up to a chair or a table or something like that, and he ties a string to the door, so if anybody came in through the front door... They were going to get into a surprise that would really ruin your day. And that's why when the mailman noticed that nothing was happening, you know, no one was picking up the mail. And so he went around the side to look in, and that's when he saw
a bunch of flies and a smell.
Mrs. Marston's, you know, headless body. Right. Essentially, and then they later on said they broke in either through the back or through the side or whatever, and they said, you know, it's a good thing you didn't come in through the front door. And and they just said, you know, he says he was just so evil that not only did he and his wife do a murder suicide, but then he wanted to take somebody else out just because he wanted to, you know. And one person even said, you know, in my lifetime, I have known two evil people, truly evil people. One was Adolf Hitler, and the other one was Hubie Marston.
Now, let me ask this. The Marston House, Ben comes into town and he actually wanted to rent it. Because it's basically abandoned. And even when he was a kid, when he did the dare to get in and steal the snow globe and all that, it was abandoned too. But it was purchased before he comes in by Straker and Barlow. But the odd thing is who owned the property? I forget.
Technically, Straker did not buy the prop. Did he?
They bought it from the realtor guy, money guy in town.
Yeah, they made shady deals under the table to make sure that they got
it. Right, but
yeah, but
I don't care about that. I'm curious how, because I forget, how did the realtor own the property or who owned the property and who was he selling it for?
Well, I don't think they ever mentioned it, did they? Because it was just kind of hanging on the hill for a long time and as a ghost house. You know, no one.
I think somehow he had title to it.
What happened was, as he said, I think what happened was when he first meets Straker, the realtor guy, he said, you know, you're going to buy it. And I can't remember how he said, but essentially he says, I'm going to give you a dollar. You know, it's like, you're going to buy it, but then like, I'm going to give you a dollar or whatever, but then you're also going to have all of this fantastic property that's just going to be worth absolute millions. Because the thing is that he had to be, they had to be invited in. That's why he couldn't actually buy the property.
Right. Because obviously one of them is a vampire. But my question is Larry Crockett, the realtor,
right?
How does he get to purchase it? Because I don't think we ever find out who owns the property, right? I mean, someone has to own the property. It can't just be sitting there unless the state unclaimed, you know, property that's one of that type of thing. But it's never mentioned. I mean, it's not important really, but it is.
Somehow
curious.
He acquires the property. We don't really get a good idea.
Right. He acquires it for Straker and gives it to Straker while Straker said, you know, now you're going to, you know, I'll give you this property in exchange or something like that.
Yeah. And basically, Straker has some dirt on and make sure that the deal is dirty so he can have the guy under his thumb whenever he needs something.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so Larry Crockett seems like the regular businessman, but he's made a nice little fortune by doing, I guess, shady deals. Some of them illegal, but some of them also going around corners to get them to, you know, loopholes, things like that.
Some of it was shady. A lot of it was just, he was just shrewd business guy. He was probably the only one who really had bought and sold real estate in the town. You know, he was kind of, he had his hands in a lot of things. So,
And so that's how the property becomes now owned by Straker and Barlow. Even though we none of us know actually how anybody could even get the property because we didn't even know who owned it. Because once Hubie Marston kills himself, the property would technically be in his estate or something. But again, who cares? We'll just move on.
Well, if that was the case, wasn't Marston working for Straker and Barlow to make sure the house was theirs?
Oh, you actually technically kind of, sort of, right? Didn't, because there's rumors that Marston, later in the book, there's rumors that Marston was Straker, was the early version of Straker for Barlow.
Yeah, no, what happened was, Marston was in communication, was writing back and forth with Barlow.
Correct. Right,
because Straker explains to the kid, he said, you know, my master, you know, knew Hubie Marston, even though he never had the opportunity to meet him, you know. And so because Hubie Marston was actually inviting Barlow to come to his town.
Right.
You know, and so they said they never actually met each other, but they were in communication with each other for quite some time.
Right, right. So for folks who are curious, it should be noted that basically Straker is the human protector of Barlow, who we eventually find out is basically the vampire, the ancient vampire. And unlike the TV miniseries and Nosferatu, the movie and whatnot, he looks similar to Dracula or something. Yeah, like he's basically, it's almost implied that he is Dracula, to be honest.
I mean,
because it says that I've had many names and all this other stuff, and I'm old as from whenever. But go on, if you're saying.
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting that I found the character Barlow to be the least fascinating part of the vampire occurrences. It's more the happenings that are brought upon by his arrival that are more interesting than himself. Because I found the character kind of, well, he just feels like Dracula, you know what I'm saying? He doesn't feel like anything really stand out. His design in the TV miniseries was memorable, but here he's kind of just a guy.
I disagree in one respect, and that is the respect of his machinations are so incredible that he's like 10 steps ahead of everybody.
And also, Abe, the book is intentionally written with, even though he's a member of the ensemble cast, he's mentioned or his perspective is very limited. They show him maybe when he takes out Dud, the guy that runs the junkyard, and then they show him when he, I think, takes out Floyd. But
everyone is affected by him.
He's affected by
him. It's like it's a lot like the novel Dracula, because you never see him at the beginning. I mean, you don't see Dracula much. I mean, the book is labeled entitled Dracula, but you hardly ever see him.
But the way the story is told in Dracula is through like letters and stuff like that. It's not like a regular narrative.
But what are you trying to get at, Abe?
That's what I'm trying to say is I found that the character Barlow was kind of the least interesting part of the novel.
I have to admit, I don't know if I don't think I agree, because I think
me neither.
I mean, he's very, for example, he had Straker do a lot of his dirty work. But the thing is that when it came time for him to act, he acted, and he did his own dirty work too. I mean, he's the one.
Well, I never said he didn't do anything. I never said he didn't do anything.
He's a master chessman from all his experience in time lived, and that's where I think he has the biggest effect, because they get stymied so much because they're not expecting him to be ready for them in all situations.
Well, right. all I'm saying is I just didn't find him as interesting as the other events.
You're in the minority, sir. You are in the minority.
Whatever.
I mean, he even boasts, like he was, I think in the one letter, I mean, he boasts that, he pretty much said, tried to say, oh yeah, he's from the time of Eden. And I'm like, yeah, right, sure. But, I mean, that's kind of his, I mean, he's very arrogant because he's lived for so long, and he says, you know, I fought against people, and, you know, people tried to stop me before, and I mean, I don't know. I just think he's very fascinating. He's very intelligent. He's also very arrogant, but at the same time, though, I just thought he was a very formidable opponent, and I don't know, his scenes, I mean, he was very seductive in a way of appealing, you know, not seductive like he was trying to appeal to women, but seductive as in, you want to serve me, for example, with Dud, you know, he's like, serve me and I'll get you the girl that you really want. And then with that other guy that literally gets caught with his, you know, well, he gets caught with more than his pants down, but, you know, he's running outside, you know, with
shit running down his leg.
Yeah, he crapped his pants, you know, and then, you know, so he sees Barlow treats him with respect. He says, hey, you know, you come with me, we'll get revenge against this guy who did that to you. I mean, it's just Barlow was, and the thing is that it's very, I mean, coming from a, you know, from a Christian perspective, I mean, he does sound very much devilish.
I think for me, his strongest scene was with Father Callahan. I thought that was his strongest scene. That was because that, you know, aside from, because the other characters he runs into are just all very minor characters. But in that scene, it's the first time we have at least an important supporting character in conflict, especially one of the most important instruments in fighting the vampires being taken out, which is, I think, was the best scene. But I found, for the most part, I found Barlow to be very, very uninteresting.
You suck, Abe.
Oh,
shit. Curse you, Abe Spinney!
I don't agree with you, but I also don't think you suck, Abe.
Thank you. Eat it, Bill. Eat it. But interesting thing on the subject of villains, I found that it's, for Straker, I found that his approach to talking to everybody was kind of strange that he could get very far, because when we see him in the miniseries as a comparison, he is very suave and he's very charismatic and he's able to talk to people and convince them. In this case, in this novel, he is very blunt and very callous.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Not really.
I'm sorry,
I have to disagree. He's right. Blunt and callous with...
he's a jerk.
He's blunt and callous with the realtor guy,
and with the kid in the house, and
right. But not in his shop with the women. He was very kind. He offered a woman a chair. They said, you know, he was very suave. But then they said, but you know, something about him. It's like some of the women are like, oh, wow, you know, he's really, you know, charming. But then one or two of them said, yeah, but there was something about his eyes.
What about how he acted with the cop? What do you think of that in the book?
I think he acted respectfully towards him. I mean, in a manner, it's like, okay, fine. He knew, you know, it's like, look, this is a small town. I'm a suspect. He cooperated, you know, he said, I mean, he talked down to him, you know, as far as like, you're not as intelligent as I am, but he...
Plus, you don't want to be harassed by the cop, right? It's like,
right,
like,
but I mean, it's essentially, he said, you know, he's like, look, I mean, when he said ciao, you know, that's Italian for goodbye. I mean, he would talk down to him a little bit, but he said, but he never, he's, when Gillespie said, hey, you know, I want a copy. I want your suit. He says, yeah, okay. You know, he just says, please bring it back to me at a certain time. And I don't, you know. And
now, let me say this. Before this discussion, I 100% agreed with Abe, because he does seem like a prick in the book and someone that is very dirty. But Kevin and Barrett have a good point, which is he's only that way to someone else who's dirty too, which is the realtor. He's not that way to the customer. So in other words, his public face to the customers is still maybe a little snobbish New Yorker or London or wherever the hell they come from type, but not a dink.
Well,
but he is a dink to the realtor. While in the TV show, he's kind of, you know, plays it cool the whole film. But go on.
Yeah, well, what I was trying to say is, I think that the portrayal of his suaver parts is more prominent in the TV series than it is in the novel. Because
that
only,
is true.
It you know, we only hear about his more charming parts in passing than we do in any of his scenes.
That's a good point. You're absolutely right. Yeah. All right. You gotta give Abe a point there, because most of the scenes.
He's right there.
Yeah. It's in passing, you hear that he seems suave. Like, have you gone to that shop? Yeah, he's a nice guy. You know, he helped me get the chair, whatever. But in the miniseries, we obviously see all that. But in the book, all we see is him being a dink to the people he talks to, which are usually either crooks or people he wants to kill.
Yeah, because I remember reading the scene where he talks to the realtor and also watching that scene. And the way both business goes out there is just thinking like, okay, it's kind of strange. He's being. I understand he has dirt on the guy, but you know, you're kind of pushing his buttons. You know, you want the house. Why are you know you gotta be. I will be playing cards close to your chest since you want to get your vampire boss.
I have to agree with you, Abe. I liked the performance of James Mason in the miniseries more than I liked the character in the book, because in the character in the book was too risky, I felt, for trying to get away with what he was planning to get away with.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because Donald Sutherland played the role in the later one, and Donald Sutherland was not suave at all. He was eccentric at best, a little, weird.
Twitchy.
Twitchy, he was very odd, you know, but then...
he's a weird guy anyway.
Now, funny thing is,
yes, what?
Now, funny thing is, I really did like the performance of... he played the Hitcher. I forgot the actor's name. Shit.
Rucker Hauer.
I really liked his performance as Barlow in the remake miniseries.
Yes. He was perfect for that role.
Yeah. I think what's interesting is it's kind of interesting. I think it really helped the character because it really kind of sees how the character carries himself in displaying both his power and his authority. It's just kind of, it was interesting seeing this older gentleman do this. But it kind of, I think what kind of ruined that major scene that I mentioned with Paul Callahan was what they did to Callahan, because Callahan is a very interesting character in the novel.
Yes.
You know, cause he, and the first miniseries, he's a throwaway character. The other one, they make him more of a guy fall away from God and becoming corrupt. And this, he is a person who's finding the strength of his faith, but is trying to deal with the very fact he becomes corrupted, not by choice, but because of what happens to him in the novel when he faces Barlow.
I mean, I could really get into Father, talking about Father Callahan when the time comes, because, I mean, in the book, Father Callahan, he was known to be a little bit of a drinker, but, not like an alcoholic. But I think it was also, he was a guy who... I think when he found out that there was a vampire, it was almost like he was excited. It's like, good, something, he was more like, it's kind of hard to explain.
Well, you know, like,
it's more like, hey, action now instead
exactly.
of, I'm writing a history of this or I'm writing of this and. Yeah, I'm a priest in a small town, big bleeping deal. And all of a sudden you get this, a vampire, I can actually do something spiritual and fight evil. Like in other words, there was like a
he would have evil meaning
personified in his life. Yeah, have a big mission.
Actually tangible that he could fight.
He felt like a true protector. He felt like he actually had a mission rather than just kind of... And there's a great scene where he... When they cleanse the Marston house, when he puts the cross on the building,
yeah,
and the windows blow out, and he's absolutely stunned by the glowing power of the whole actual faith.
He recites like an exorcism prayer or declaration, and that's when that happens, and then later on he puts a wafer on the door to seal it.
Well, I think the thing about Callahan is that, like any human being, he's not expecting supernatural things to actually occur in the real world. In other words, everything is spiritual and faith. But when he sees things that are real, like a vampire or windows blowing out or whatever, I think that amazes him no differently than it amazes any other person.
I think it's very important. It's very important to Callahan because he is a man of faith, but he didn't realize the true importance of faith until that very moment where he had to use it.
Yeah.
You mean when he faces Barlow?
Well, when he first cleanses the house. And then he faces Barlow. He kind of starts to seem like it's almost like. He finds that power, but he doesn't really understand the complete use of it, because when he faces Barlow, he kind of takes it for granted because he thinks just the idea of having the cross was enough. Because
well, what happened was is that he put his faith into an object.
Exactly.
And the thing, for example, speaking personally, I do agree. I identify with Callahan to the point of, you know, I mean, I read my Bible. I go to church. I pray, you know, but you don't see, you know, essentially, I don't see miracles very much or at all. You know, I really don't. I mean, I hear of things happening. You hear of things happening in other places. You know, I know people who have actually done exorcisms, you know.
Well, that's the supernatural thing I was talking about.
But that's the super right. And the thing is that now you're actually seeing the supernatural. And I may have seen some guy, you know, an exorcism take place. But that's a totally different story. But when Callahan faces Barlow and when he realizes that his faith is, you know, in pretty much what seems like his faith is really in a cross, and then, you know, and it's just when he's being confronted by this evil that's a lot more powerful than his own faith, you know, the cross fades and he kind of tosses it away. But the thing that Barlow said that really fascinated me was, if you had thrown away your cross, I would not have been able to face you.
Right. Well, and
that's the thing I find interesting is that I think he got psyched out by Barlow. I think he had power without the cross.
Well, it's
and
more,
I'll tell you why. What I was going to say is that I don't necessarily blame him, and this is the reason why, is that, okay, let's say Barlow is a bad guy, right?
Or a vampire.
All right, right. But that's not my point. My point is that Callahan knows this guy's a bad guy or a vampire or a combination of both. But even if you believe in God, or even if you're a Catholic priest or a Protestant minister or a Jewish rabbi or whatever, that doesn't necessarily mean the evil you're going to face is directly the evil of hell. In other words, you know, you could face a terrorist or a Nazi or a Soviet or, you know, gulag or whatever, and you can put a cross up to them and nothing's going to happen. And you're still going to get shot and killed or murdered or tortured or whatever. So even though he has the cross and he's facing this evil person or individual or beast, if you prefer, that doesn't necessarily mean in his eyes, even if it's argued that it's a faith issue, it could be a faith issue, but it still may have not worked, at least in his perspective, because again, you know, what happens if it was, if we're going to talk supernatural here, what happens if it was a gray alien or a zombie or something, you know, none of that's going to work on them. So unless you believe in some fake myths about what vampires can or cannot do, even though there's one in front of you, you honestly don't know if the cross is going to work, right?
So, well, here's the thing. The very fact of asking him to throw it away made him question it.
Oh, there's no doubt, right, because it does work.
So that's how it works, I think, is not necessarily that it was his faith that powered the cross, but by saying, hey, throw your cross away, made him question his own faith, and that caused him to lose the power that he had gained.
Oh, I'm not disagreeing with any of that. I'm just saying that in his perspective, for him to lose that faith and to start questioning is a very human thing. And
oh, yeah.
Especially since you don't know if it's going to work. Because what happens if he said, okay, I'm going to hold it, I will throw away the cross. And then Barlow says, aha, I tricked you. And he takes and snaps his head anyway. You know what I'm saying? So it just doesn't. It's just a curiosity, I think, that he becomes unclean because he lost his faith and he was psyched. But again, priest or rabbi or minister or whatnot, this is his first time you're actually seeing in truth, in fact, a supernatural thing. Right,
no,
and you don't know if that it could be quantum physics. That's supernatural too, and it has nothing to do with God.
They also found they encountered Susan first.
What's that?
They encountered Susan before Barlow.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'll give you that, Abe. Susan becomes a vampire, yeah, because she fucked up.
Yeah.
That was probably one of the things that always bugged me. It's like, what the fuck are you doing going there for those fence posts?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you why. because again, they still don't believe 100% that they're supernatural either. So they're just thinking they're breaking into a home where they have a little curiosity that, well, maybe there is vampires in here. But she's still not 100% sure because she's never seen a vampire. She's just been told that there's vampires and wants to find out for herself.
So the idea is Petrie knew. Oh, Mark absolutely knew.
Yeah, I don't care about Mark. I'm talking about Susan. Susan hasn't seen anything yet.
Well, just going by herself was very foolish. I don't care if you think that they're not supernatural. They're two men, and she, you know, by herself and a boy, I don't think they're going to stop them.
Yeah. Well, you've got two men. One of them, you know, and you're pretty sure that one of them is killed somebody. You might not want to go in there. You know, it's just not a good
especially
idea.
Especially you try to sneak into a house with a sharp fence post, it's going to look pretty fucking bad. Even if it's just a misunderstanding, it's absolutely idiotic.
The only thing I can account that for is that possibly he's drawing them there so that he can split them apart, using their own wants against them. That's the only thing I can think of.
Well,
otherwise, it doesn't make a ton of sense for them to go there.
I mean, for Mark, it does, because he's a young kid. He's seen vampires, and he was.
Yeah.
Well, not only that, but he's also seen, you know, the vampire. So he finds himself, he sees himself as an expert just because he watched a bunch of Hammer films.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, when he read a lot of horror comics. So he's like, okay, well, I should know what's going on.
Right. And he's a stupid kid.
It's right before, I mean, it's not long before sunset. You know, it's like, look, if you're such an expert, why are you going at 4:30 when
instead
you could be going at like
right, exactly.
Yeah,
that stuff's always bugged me about it, but you know, I can look past that.
Now, interesting thing is when the way that they describe Stryker as a formidable creature makes you wonder if he was. Not he was somehow in, he was enhanced in strength and stuff.
Oh, he was.
Oh, he was. Yeah.
I think he was almost like a ghoul, almost like a Renfield in a way.
Oh yeah, well, like a dog's body.
I mean, who knows what he? For example, they're talking about when he was lifting up this chair, and they said that thing had to have been because that they were saying that thing was solid. That thing was heavy. That had to be heavy.
Right.
And there's other times where they talk about him just lifting stuff up, and this is. I know how that's like over 200 pounds, and he's lifting it up like it's like only 20. You know,
right? And he's supposed to be retiring, right? You know, it's not like he's a 25 year old.
And they said, you know, this guy is very strong. You know, and
yeah, it was interesting too because it's nice. It's a nice little detail to very. I think nothing spankful of King is in his early work is the subtle little details that kind of enhance the characters.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He isn't going to complete, like, backstory of ghouls and stuff like that. He just kind of gives you a little idea to show, like, Stryker is not just a strange, mysterious figure, but he's not exactly normal in the slightest.
Right. Well, I mean, he doesn't really go into Stryker's perspective much at all in the novel. It's always through other people.
Well, I would say he never outright says that Stryker is a ghoul or anything. He just gives you an idea that Stryker is just abnormal.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you kind of get that, though, from the vampire mythos. We always know that there's this a human person that helps out, and some of those human people have extra powers than regular humans.
Yeah, well, I'm saying, you know, but Stryker seems like a normal guy. He's not eating bugs like Renfield.
Well, we have. I'm not talking about just Renfield. I'm just talking about in general. There's in vampire films and whatnot. There's always been these human characters that have been like supernatural, even though they're just human.
To watch over them during the day.
Yeah. But the way they approach them is very different. You know, like in Fright Night, they have such a character, but the creature is pretty much a walking corpse at one point after he starts melting.
Right. Exactly. Now, let's discuss what happens. So basically, the Glick kids one of them gets kidnapped or disappears, and so they just assume it's kidnapping, and then we see a perspective of a shadowy person, which we find out later is actually Stryker, sacrificing the kid to the Satan, basically. So by killing the dog and then by killing the kid, Ralphie, it begins to somehow, it's something to do with a thing where it allows the vampire Paolo to come to the town.
Yeah, because they also had, because Stryker took another step, like getting rid of the dog because it had apparently markings that were similar to something in the legends about warding off dark spirits and stuff.
Right.
Right.
So what happens next is Danny Glick, I guess, is patient zero in a sense, where he is turned into a vampire by Barlow. And then from there, we have, one bites one, and then that one becomes a vampire. Then you have two vampires, and two bite two, and then two to four, and eight, and 16, and so on. And as this is happening, Ben begins to figure it out, because obviously he already has a affinity for what the Marston House represents. And so he starts recruiting people.
Well, actually, no, he doesn't. I'm sorry, but he doesn't figure it out. He doesn't really know what's going on until the teacher.
That's right.
Matt
visited.
Matt Burke.
Yeah, yeah. Matt Burke gets visited by Mike Ryerson. You know, yeah, famous "Look at Me, teacher." You know, you'll sleep like the dead teacher. That scene. First it was, you know, Mike Ryerson was in his room because, you know, Ryerson got bit by Danny.
Yep.
And then, you know, he was starting to suspect something because he was trying to sleep and he could hear, you know, the voice in his guest room. And next thing you know, Ryerson's dead. And so that's when Burke started suspecting vampires. And it was either the next day or a couple of days later, right. You know, that's when the famous and the great look at me teacher scene happens.
Let's get into that. So basically what happens is it's fairly similar to the movie, this part. Basically, Danny Glick takes out Ryerson, who is the gravedigger, and then he is seen at a bar by Matt Burke. We learn about Matt Burke earlier because he used to, he knows Ben Mears from his writing, and so they become friends. And then Ryerson is taken home by Burke. Burke dies at the house, and as Kevin said, he heard voices.
Ryerson. Right.
Ryerson dies at Burke's house, and Burke mentions he hears voices up there by a child, which we can gather is Danny Glick. Ryerson obviously dies and becomes a vampire eventually. Then he gets Mears involved and asks for Mears to bring a crucifix, but Mears isn't a Catholic or an Eastern Orthodox or whatnot. And so he gets it from his landlady at the boarding house, and that landlady begins to be suspicious because isn't Mears a Lutheran or a Presbyterian or something? He's not a Catholic. And so you're right. And that's how it all begins, where they find Ryerson, just like in the movie, and he has the heart attack and he lands up in the hospital.
Yeah. Right. And it's essentially from that point, as more people start to join the cause against the vampires,
which Matt is where Jimmy Cody gets involved. The doctor.
Yeah. But what's nice is kind of a little links between the Dracula novel and stuff. Is Matthew pretty much becomes, because they even say this, is that Matthew basically becomes Van Helsing of the group.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So Burke is kind of the de facto leader, even though he's incapacitated. And we have Jimmy Cody, who's the doctor, gets involved, and then we have the big scene at the funeral parlor, which I think is the Jewish funeral parlor. I think because they haven't opened them yet, and that's why there's no crucifixes at the parlor.
Yeah, they use the tongue depressors to make some.
Right.
So, Jim, this scene is one of the best, but I thought it was a little odd, too, because why would Jimmy Cody believe Matt, unless he's just trying to humor them? But
the doctor? Yeah,
well, the doctor was
He sees a lot of the cases where people have lost blood.
Blood and stuff like that, and he gets the gist of it.
Yeah, I mean, he hears what Matt Burke has to say, he hears what Ben Mears has to say, and he realizes, you know, these people aren't nuts. So he says, all right. And he says, you know, I want to prove this. I want to prove this scientifically. So he says, this is the best way to do it is
just to show them nothing's going to happen.
Yeah.
Right.
And then what happens is the Jewish funeral parlor owner, I forget his name. You don't even actually see him in the book.
You talk to him briefly.
Yeah, that's a good point. He's friends with Jimmy Cody because obviously Jimmy being a doctor. And when folks pass away, he knows a lot of the funeral parlor people because
he also saved the guy's son's life.
Yeah, that's right. He did. Yeah. And that's probably the main reason why he would allow this to happen because Yeah. Because you figure it's illegal to let people just hang out at a funeral parlor with
around bodies and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the official story was Cody was saying, well, I want to see if there was any signs of this particular disease. Yeah. And so, you know, that's the reason, because I mean, when the police come later, he says, you know, hey, you know, I just wanted to inspect. And well, why is the author here? Well, you know, I'm just here for story material. You know, so they weren't breaking the law doing that, you know, but
they just had to come up with some stuff to cover their asses.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so this is when Jimmy Cody gets involved and actually believes it as well. And everybody now believes it because they see Danny Glick's mother, who's become a vampire because of Danny Glick. Basically resurrect from the dead as a vampire.
Yeah. And it's a pretty chaotic scene. In this case, Jimmy actually even gets bitten, and they kind of leave it hanging in the air as to how infectious the bite just being bitten is, because Cody has to try to sterilize and wash it. To try to see if he can stop himself from catching whatever it is spreading.
Yeah, he pours disinfectant on the wound, and he has Mears inject him with a tetanus booster shot.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And you can't blame him.
Yeah, but the interesting, it kind of suggests, though, that you have to die from the blood loss in order to be turned.
Right, but I think they know enough of the mythos that if you get bit, because Jimmy keeps on saying in the novel, oh, it's unclean, and I don't think he's just meaning because of the tetanus. I think he's also meaning because of the being tainted by the saliva and fangs of.
Well, I think maybe also spiritually unclean too, because I mean, there's even a point where he said he was watching Ben fight the vampire. And there was this urge in him to fight Ben.
Right.
Yep.
That's
true.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yep. Yeah. So basically, he similar to Lucy Westerner in Dracula, where she gets bit, and actually, even though she's still human, she's now slightly under the power of evil in Dracula because she wants to actually help Dracula. Same here, where Jimmy Cody, even though he's human and a good guy, he's been bit by basically the spawn of Satan, and now is tainted with Satan's power and wants to actually help Danny Glick's mother, the vampire, fight Ben because of that taint.
Yeah, and the vampires also have this ability to cause, mainly Barlow, but the other vampires are capable of this too, by to hypnotize and pretty much paralyze humans, either from making them inactive or make them turn on each other.
Right, don't look at their eyes.
Yeah, exactly. Because Matthew nearly falls, happens to him with Mike Ryerson. Mark Petrie nearly opens the door for Danny by looking into his eyes. And he even attacks Ben in the finale when he looks into Barlow's eyes.
Right.
Right. As well as numerous insignificant characters that we see throughout the story where they get turned as well.
One of the cops, I think it was a sheriff or a constable, looks into Barlow and Susan's eyes and he gets jumped by them.
They talk about the cheerleader, basically Larry Clarkett's daughter, which is like the hot cheerleader, Dud, who is the owner, or not the owner, but the guy that runs, the manages the junkyard.
Dud.
He's always had the hots for the cheerleader. And they talk about a scene where she now lives in the junkyard in a refrigerator turned as a vampire because of Dud. And there's no, you know, when she was a human, she used to laugh at Dud because Dud has like a hunchback. And yet once she sees Dud as a vampire, she is, you know, hypnotized and becomes a vampire because Dud gets to turn her. So... yeah, so that we see a lot of that stuff throughout where people, like you said, Abe, are the typical mythos of vampires, where if you look in their eyes, you can be hypnotized, basically.
They also kind of use a lot of the extra steps that to kill vampires, because when they take out Susan, they have to not only, after driving a stake through, they have to drop, I think, weigh down the body and everything like that to make sure it stays.
Didn't they have to cut off her head too?
I don't know.
What I remember was is that they drove the stake in her body, but then they took her in the coffin, and then they had to like flip it over, and then they put it in running water.
Right.
That's what, you know, that's like to keep her dead.
Yeah. There's a lot of those extra steps in the old mythos that are kind of left out in a lot of vampire stories today.
Well, it's kind of funny because I remember you with the Dracula by Martin Scorsese, when you have Anthony Hopkins and they're talking to him, he says, "You're not gonna do an autopsy on her, are you?" He says, "No. I just want to cut off her head and take out her heart."
Yeah.
What? He just says it so nonchalantly, and they kind of walk away from him. He's just like, "What? Hello? What's up?"
Let's see. What other scenes do we want to talk about in the book? So you have your merry band of fighters, and obviously Barlow is trying to take them, pick them off one by one. At one point, Straker finally is eliminated. Basically, they claim it's Barlow that does it. At least Barlow pretends he did it. But really, Mark Petrie clubs him over the head with a lead pipe, which basically kills him or takes him out.
You think he's dead? I think that Barlow actually killed him.
Guess. This is what I think. I think he got clubbed by Mark and probably was like had bones broken and all this other stuff, and so Barlow just kills him because he's pissed.
Yeah,
plus I don't think Straker could help anyway, because what's he going to do, bring him to the hospital?
Well, I think Barlow even mentions during in the letter he sent to him that he forced his own hunger on, was forced to satiate his hunger on him as well, because they mentioned that Straker is drained. He's not just, his thirst is not just, like, he's drained of blood.
Well, yeah, he was hung upside down and drained of blood. It was kind of a punishment type of thing.
Yeah. As you mentioned, the upside down, crossed and bogged.
Like Mussolini. Like Mussolini.
Yeah.
You basically, when Mussolini...
I'll take your word for it.
Okay.
Mussolini, whatever. When Mussolini was captured and executed for war crimes by the Italians, they took him and his mistress and hung him upside down because that represented their souls going to hell. And so this is kind of like that. At least it reminded me of Mussolini's death. But the main thing is, and they even say it in the book, they doubt that he intentionally kills Straker because that shows weakness because he needs Straker. So my guess, and that's my personal opinion based off of that and what Mark does to Straker, is the guy was going to be incapacitated for at least a month with injuries, and there's no way he was going to go to the hospital, so Straker just was killed by Barlow.
I think Barlow just got rageful and did it. That's my
yeah,
feeling.
In the letter, he tries to play it off as, it wasn't my fault that he died. Because he says, you made me lose a most valuable servant.
Right. Yeah, like his most valuable he's ever had or something like that.
Yeah, so I think he was done anyway. So I'm disagreeing with you, Barrett.
That's fine. I think he went enraged and killed him.
Oh, well, that's possible, too. I mean, it wouldn't be surprised that he did go enrage and kill him, but I don't think...
It was
think,
either that, or maybe he was at, like, death's door or something like that. And so,
oh, that's the thing. There's no way Straker was going to get out of it. Because
basically, Straker...
He would either have been in a hospital, or he was at a death's door. So it wouldn't surprise me that he was dead anyway, but would not surprise me if Barlow just had a massive psychopathic moment and decided to snap, kill him.
Basically, Straker was a prize horse with a broken leg, and Barlow took him out.
Right. Well, and he had probably had a concussion too.
He probably had a fractured skull. Broken. I mean,
he was a pile of broken bones and blood. He was up shit creek, anyways.
Yeah, I mean, there was no way he was going to survive. So Barlow probably just took advantage of the situation and just drank his blood because it's like, well, I guess I'm not going out, so I better get what I have here, because isn't there some sort of mythos that, vampires get hurt or weakened if they drink the blood of a dead person?
Maybe. I'm not sure.
I don't know.
I've heard that one.
Because, I mean, it was in the interview with a vampire. I mean,
you're probably right. I mean, a lot of these mythos are all just made up anyway for convenience of story. So he, in his hundreds of books of vampires, so it wouldn't surprise me if that's one
and
of them.
The mythos has been changed so many times with a lot of, as I said, in today's media, most of we saw the stake and beheading, but... The missing step of the missing steps of like the running water and turning the body upside down are kind of been removed.
Right. Well, I mean, there are different
ways. What?
No, I was just gonna say that like in the novel Dracula, the sunlight doesn't kill them; it just makes them
weak.
Weaker, yeah.
Yeah.
So be it. But that's mythos. Let's get back to the novel itself. What other scenes do we want to discuss?
I thought it was very interesting how we get it was interesting how they kind of showed how they begin the story with the two main characters as runaways. Like, they already established who's left before we
Who's
lost.
Yeah.
Right. And then the kid wants to become a priest.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
In order to do that, he has to make confession, and the priest comes to him and says, "I heard this confession." Say what? I mean, that was kind of his reaction. He says, "Could you please tell me the story from your point of view?" And and that's when Ben says, "Yeah, everything he told you was right."
Let's talk about something I think we missed completely, which is Constable Parkins Gillespie. What did you guys think of his story? And I felt
he was
that
the smartest one of all.
Yeah, not only the smartest,
get the fuck out of there.
Not only was he the smartest, but I think his storyline was the most realistic too, because he was doing what he would consider his job. In other words, a boy goes missing. People start having issues. Who do you want to investigate? The new people in town. And in his eyes, Straker, Barlow, and Mears are all the same, because before any of them showed up, there was no problems.
Right.
And so he starts doing various things, and he plays it smart where he kind of isn't a dink. And so, like Barlow, I mean, not Barlow, Straker, he goes, "Could I see your suit?" And immediately that means you're a suspect, is basically what he's implying to Straker. And Straker gives him the suit because he's not going to find anything on the suit. But also, with Gillespie, by asking the question, he puts the guy on the spot, and he's also watching to see how he's going to react and all these other things. And so I don't know. I just like that plot the most. And as I've seen in other Stephen King novels, such as The Outsider and things like that, he actually is as good a police procedural writer as he is as a horror writer. And even though this is only a small part of this novel and not in the forefront, I felt it was probably the most interesting and the part I enjoyed the most. But maybe that's just me. I don't know. What do you guys
think? I mean, Gillespie was good. I mean, yeah, he did. I mean, you could tell he did his job. He was doing what he was supposed to be doing. You know, I mean, I understand Mears, you know, really angry with them, because, you know, even Gillespie figured out, okay, he never actually said the word vampire, but he knew what was going on. You know, and I kind of like the line he said, you know, "My deputy, you know, didn't come in today. I don't expect him. I don't think he's ever going to come in."
Right.
You know, it's like he knew.
Right, right, right. And he's wearing a cross, and he's wearing a peace symbol, and all these other things. Yeah. And, you know, and he's not a Catholic, and he has no idea about religion.
The guy was very John Rosati. You know, he pretty much did every smart thing that we yelled at people on TV screen to do.
Right, right. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even wearing a peace symbol is hilarious, because it's like, I can't hurt, so I might as well wear that. You know, and you're right. He's exactly everything that we are, the audience, want the characters to do, which is just get the fuck out of there, dude. You can't win, you know? And so that was an excellent point, Abe. I love that, because, yeah, he is the character. He may not be the character that we're supposed to identify with. It's supposed to be Mears, I guess. But he's the smartest, as you said, Barrett, and also the character that the audience, meaning me for sure, would be saying, this is what you got to do. And that's what I would have done too, which is, all right, once you figure out that, as you said, Kevin, the deputy ain't coming in, and I don't think he ever is coming in again, I'm out of here.
Because, I mean, I think it was at the beginning of the novel, even, they were reading news clips, you know, about people from Salem's Lot, and Gillespie was one of them. But there were like one or two other people that said, yeah, I left and I don't really want to talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. There was like one of the women that worked at the diner. I forget who they all were. But, oh, the gas station, the guy that owned the gas station, he just leaves.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And then. Then Gillespie goes and moves in with his sister in like another state or something. There's or a couple of
Florida.
Towns. Yeah, Florida. Yeah, yeah. And because there is an interesting way to start the novel, because it's like Jerusalem's Lot, a small quaint village that used to have a hopping, nice, you know, touristy type community, and then suddenly it's a dead town, and they go and search for a handful of the people that are still on record, and none of them want to talk.
Yeah.
Or they lie and just say, oh, you know.
That
gas station guy says, well, you know, the the business is dried up, you know, even though he probably may know more too. But, you know, what are you going to do? Say the vampires took over? But what are you going to say?
But what was really cool is just you when we watch these scenes of the people becoming sick and tired and people disappearing or hiding in little closets and in basements and stuff like that as the infection spreads. This is one of the things I always loved a little more about the villain itself. It's just the effect everything it has, because you see this everything just slowly, the town slowly die. You know, yeah. We see every little slowing pulse as the page turns.
I think that the scene that got me actually is when the baby died.
Oh, yeah, that was really freaked up.
That, I mean, I have to admit, King really just played, because, I mean, you know, the mother was a jerk. You know, and you can tell she really didn't want to be, but it's just more of, you know, she really did love the kid, but she was also just frustrated just with life in general. You know, her husband right. really wasn't much of a help. And then,
she was probably like, didn't want to. And oh, she got married young and had a child young, maybe on even mistake. Yeah. And obviously, you know, came from a lower income family, uneducated family. So she had like issues where had she been in a different situation, she probably would have gone and got a skill and all this other stuff. But yeah, I mean, she lives in a trailer, right? And
right. About it. And the funny part is like, you never hear about her parents.
No.
It's almost like her parents have abandoned her just because of all this. But the thing is, it's like, when she wakes up and she sees her baby, the vampire just took the baby, finished with it, and just threw it in the corner.
It was
like, it was just done, yeah. Because like the leg was sticking up and all that. And, you know, she's like, how the heck did that happen? And she was trying to keep, cause like the baby looks all right. You know, here, have some pudding, you know, the pudding just falls out of the baby's mouth. And she realizes, oh my goodness, the baby's dead. You know, I mean, it's just, that was just so heartbreaking.
Yeah, and it kind of really just, you know, it was such a well-written scene. It was so unsettling. Yes. One thing is, aside from maybe the death of Jimmy Cody and Straker, most of the deaths that take place are kind of very subdued in comparison. Yeah. You know, they're more about the unease of death itself, but rather than the gore and everything.
Right. Right. And like another scene that I liked was more or less the epilogue, where they were reading stories some of it was newspaper clippings. Other of it was just how other people got it. Like one person, like their best friend called them on the phone.
Yeah.
He says, oh, yeah. Can I come over? Oh, yeah, come on in. And all of a sudden she opens up the door and, you know, she gets a rude awakening, or, you know, other people just, you know, ran away, or like other people will move into the area, but then they left again because of just weird noises happening all the time. You know, they're like, OK, this isn't what I wanted. And so they moved in. They quickly left.
That's another one of his ways of making the town feel real, by doing these random characters that you really don't know anything about, and these are the things that happen to them.
Yes, yeah, somebody did I don't know if it was Stephen King did a short story, but I heard a radio drama briefly, like it was on YouTube. It was a very poor sound quality, but they one of the stories that they talked about was a family that went into Salem's Lot, you know, it was like in the middle of winter or something like that. And they drove in, like something happened, the car broke down. And it was mentioned in Salem's Lot, but then somebody did a radio drama later of that family. And what happened to them was that, you know, their car broke down. The father went to this bar outside Salem's Lot and they're all like, get out of Salem's Lot, stay out of Salem's Lot. You don't want to go in there. Like they all knew, but then the father went back anyway. And next thing you know, they found the car, but they didn't find the family.
It's that encroaching aura of death and of the unknown that's really is what makes this so solid. That's one of the things that I love about this and Pet Sematary is just the unease that it leaves you as you turn the pages.
Right. You know, and in the end, you know, they burned down the house. They burned down the house, but then they also, as a result, because it's in the middle of the summer without a lot of rain, they end up burn. You know, they burned down the house, but then the fire spread towards the village, and they just said, you know, that's the whole, you know, fire. They say fire cleanses. You know, well, let's hope so.
Yeah.
First of all, they're never going to be able to find all the vampires. I mean, it's almost shocking that they figured it out that they were. Barlow was in the basement of the boarding house. Because it's a needle in a haystack. You know, just think of. I mean, even all right. Let's say this town only has 1,000 people or 2,000 people in it. I mean, that's still to go house to house to house to just figure it out. So you could figure that. Okay, let's burn the whole town down and hope that works.
Well, they figured that. I mean, they found Bart. Well, that's the part that I couldn't really figure out is they found Barlow because he had chalk on his sleeve or something like that.
That's right.
And they said it was from
the
pool table. And I'm thinking to myself, what did Barlow, wake up one evening and just say, before I go out, I'm going to play around a pool with my new servant, with my new vampires. It's like, how did he get chalk on him? You know, I mean, I don't.
Right, it's a little.
I don't get it. That's something I don't get. For example, the book. I'm sorry, not the book. I'm going to go into the second the second miniseries. They had the chalk, but it was from drywall, and they figured, oh well, I know that they're doing work in the basement at the boarding house, and so there's a lot of drywall and chalk from the drywall, so that it's a residue from the drywall, and that's how they figured it out.
That would make more sense.
You see, that made a whole lot more sense than a pool table.
Yeah.
Well, right. Well, plus, okay, all right, small town. Maybe there's not many pool tables, but you're right. It's just still a little convenient.
Well, how does he get the town could be full of pool tables, but
right,
how does
right.
a vampire get, chalk dust from a pool, right. from a pool little cube?
Hey, he was playing.
Playing. Yeah, you got bored.
I just had a great night, drinking a whole lot of blood. I think I'll play it around a pool before I go back to my car.
What could go wrong? How could it backfire on me at all?
Well, I mean, I'm sitting there thinking that's the only thing I can think of because, he moves the pool table, or something like. I mean, actually, technically, the pool table's there, but he doesn't even have to touch it because he just has to move like a bookshelf or something like that. I don't know. I just that's the part that I had to made me scratch my head saying, wait a minute, how did they do that?
Well, it was convenient.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. I mean, they could have had something more. I mean, King, let me rephrase that. King could have made something less obvious. He could have, like you said, it could have been like, depending on, I don't know. I mean, we've seen many movies where they figure out, the girl must be kidnapped and she's hidden in this building because of this reason. And they find fibers or they find this or whatever. Obviously, they couldn't do FBI technique type fibers. So they had to do something a little more obvious King had to do. But you're right. He could have done something a little more. Or I should say a little more realistic in a sense. And
yeah.
I guess, I mean, I'm trying to think of something right off the bat. I'm sure if I sat down for a half hour and thought about it, you could think something. I mean, you mentioned something about drywall or it could have been
rock dust or something from the basement. Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
Or sawdust or something.
Yeah, right. Or some sort of plant that you knew that someone had a hobby with.
Just some of a little more clear connection. It fits within logic.
Yeah. Yeah. But speaking of that scene, when they do take out Barlow, a couple of things. One is we find out when you kill Barlow, that doesn't mean the vampires die, in some movies. But they become loosely, they don't have a leader anymore, though. So that's why they don't like spread like crazy like zombies do, because they're just like clueless. They're almost like stupid. And then the other thing is is this is where Jimmy Cody dies. And it's a brilliant death, and unfortunate that because he was like one of my favorite characters besides Parker Gillespie. But also, it's one that we see in a lot of things. I don't know if it was prior to Stephen King or King came up with the idea, but where you have the loose staircase and the light doesn't turn on, and then you walk down the stairs and you fall to your death, and in this case, fall to a bunch of
knives.
Yeah. But either way, it's something that you would think would be too obvious, but when you're in that much of a mode, we have to get him, let's go do it. You know, you run down the stairs, who cares, the light's not on, boom, you're dead. Yeah, but anyway, what do you guys
think? In the second miniseries, it was a table saw.
Yes, I remember that, yeah.
Table saw?
Yeah, it was a running table saw. He fell onto the... Ugh.
Right, right, yeah. And in the first miniseries, he got thrown against a bunch of animals.
I think I like the knives the best, honestly, because that no, just from a, you know, falling down a running saw, they had to have the saw running beforehand. I mean, that's a little
plus you couldn't possibly hear that.
Oh, you could hear it.
Right.
The funny part is in the miniseries, you could actually hear the saw running in the background. So it's one of those they didn't say, hey, what's that I hear?
Down below.
It's in the basement. Gee, I wonder what's going on. No,
we'll go check it out.
Yeah, let's go check it out. You know, I mean, they, you know, I can't remember if they saw the floorboard. No, I think what happens is they just ended up, they just cut the stairs. Like, they had like two or three stairs going down and but into the darkness. And then after that, you know, there was nothing.
Right, yeah, they actually got rid of the stairs in this book. Right. Basically, they removed the entire staircase except for enough that go into the darkness that you think they're still there.
Right.
Yeah.
And sorry, but I mean, if I'm going to go down to the basement where I think vampires might be, I want some light.
Exactly. Yeah, at least a flashlight or something. Yeah. Yeah. Or you know what? You just wait a day. You say, you know what? Nothing we can do. A couple more people will get taken out. It's not our problem, but we're not going to risk our life at six at nighttime, and you know, without flashlights.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can say, oh, that's kind of being selfish. But I mean, it reminds me of the famous thing you hear on the airplane, which is they say, if you're an adult, put the mask over your face or before your children. And they don't tell you why, but it's obvious. It's not because they don't care about the children. It's because the children don't know what they're doing. So if you die, the children are dead anyway. So you got to make sure you don't die.
Right.
You know? So this is the same principle. It's like, you know, if you don't have light and it's 6 o'clock at night, you just leave and you come back when, you know, you can win, like at 10 a.m. in the morning.
Right. You
know? Because you already have the upper hand, which is you pretty much know where he's at. He doesn't know that you know that. So why not come back at 10 o'clock in the morning and take everybody out instead of being stupid and saying, well, we got to do it now. It's 6 o'clock at night. We don't have flashlights. You know, it's just stupid. And not disrespect for the book, because the book's awesome. But
well, I think what happened was is that they thought they had just enough time to do it. Because, you know, I mean, obviously they didn't want more people to get infected because they knew if they didn't do anything, you know, more people were going to succumb. So they figured, let's just, and also, I mean, I think you mentioned earlier, they kind of have this gung-ho thing. I mean, I'm sure that Mears wanted revenge for Susan and,
right.
You know, Petrie wanted revenge against, you know, for his parents.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and, you know, Cody just wanted to get this thing done and over with. Same thing with Callahan was gone by that time.
Yeah, Burke was already dead too.
Yeah, Burke died of another heart attack.
Yeah.
Which was sad.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah, yeah, because remember they were trying to get Glick's mother to kill him. And that,
right. It was Norton.
Oh, you're right. It was Mrs. Norton, yeah. Susan's mother. You're right. Yeah. But and they were successful. They do kill Barlow. It's just that there's a bunch of other vampires down here that they can't take out.
Yeah, there's no chain reaction effect where you kill the head vampire and all of them, as you said, die. They don't. And they just kind of scatter to the winds after the house gets set on fire.
Right. Yeah. But it's kind of a dark novel in a sense. And when I say that, is good can't really defeat evil. I mean you can kill the evil, but it's not quick. You have to go one by one, and it's not like in some of the movies, like you were just saying, Abe, where if you kill the head vampire, all the other vampires either die or all the other vampires turn back to human.
Yeah.
You know, it's more like a zombie movie where you can kill a zombie, but there's still more, and there's just more and more and more, and there's nothing you can do about it.
But it's also interesting because they were on the run. Like at the beginning, you hear them. It sounds like they're on the run, but you never really hear about them. I mean, unless if I miss something, or at least if I don't remember something. But it sounds like they're on the run. But what are they on the run from? Because you never hear of them, you know, being confronted with another vampire. It's just they leave. They go from Maine all the way down to Mexico.
Right, and it doesn't make any sense that they're running because Barlow's dead and the other vampires are stupid.
Yeah,
they don't know how to get him.
And Stryker's dead. So it's not like there's any specific individual vampire or human that's going to go after them.
Yeah, and you know, they have no leadership, so the vampires are just drones.
Right. So they could have just went away like Gillespie did and the gas station owner and the waitress at the diner and just left and settled somewhere else and not have to worry about it. But unlike Gillespie and the other folk, they either have behavioral health issues now because of what they went through and they just have shell shock or PTSD or whatever it's called, or they're just misled to believe that someone's out to get them.
I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. Is just I couldn't, because I mean, sorry to bring up the miniseries, the first miniseries, they're being chased. I mean, they kind of hint at they're being chased, because they find Susan, but I mean, they, as they're filling the holy water with little things, it's like, oh, hey, you know,
found
another
us again.
One. Another one has found us.
Yeah.
You know, but in the second miniseries,
Callahan.
Petrie and Mears are actually hunting for them. Like they're hunting the last of the vampires because they all spread out, and so they're all going around looking for them. And then you know that's where you know Callahan is, you know, kind of the new Straker, so to speak. Well, he can't be the new Straker because there's no master to serve, but he's kind of doing that. And you know, where in this one, Callahan, I read that Callahan does show up, but in later books, like one of the Dark Tower series.
Oh, he's in it. Yeah.
Yeah. He shows up in that and I can't remember what his story was, but
he has a pretty big, pretty large role in the last couple novels, I think it is.
Right. Yeah, but let's not get into the
Stephen
King mythos, because all that stuff was made, you know, 30 years after he wrote Salem's Lot, a lot of that stuff. But anyway, what are you going to say, Kevin?
No, I'm done.
Oh, okay. All right, let's see. We're almost wrapped up talking about the novel, but any other scenes, characters, or things that we missed that you guys had on your notes or in your mind, if you didn't have notes, that you wanted to bring up that we haven't talked about yet? I guess not. All right. So what we'll do is ask Kevin and Barrett if they have any stuff they wanted to let, you know, news or items they've played, like video games, books they've read, or genre TV or movies they've seen that they would recommend for some of the people who would be listening to this podcast. So let's start with you, Barrett. Anything you got, or?
I've been playing the Call of Cthulhu game on the Xbox One. It's got some good atmosphere to it. I haven't gotten very far. It's a role-playing Cthulhu game, so it's quite interesting. It's got some really good moodiness to it, and it has a good feel. And you're basically a detective investigating something. And you start getting hints of the evil as you're going.
So you're enjoying it, you think? It was worth
it's worth picking up. It's fun.
Right, how long have you been playing it for?
Just a couple weeks, but probably about 10 hours worth of time.
Okay. Mm-hmm, very good. Anything else that you wanted to bring up? Yeah, I've been thinking of picking it up myself, but I haven't yet. I'm actually doing the Blair Witch one, Xbox One Blair Witch game right now. And I've about the same, a couple of weeks, and about a couple hours, 5 or 6 hours in.
Yeah, I work slow on those games. I like to investigate everything, so I don't work very fast, but it's sure. Definitely worth picking up. You know, you gain levels, investigating stuff, paranormal stuff. It's pretty neat.
Do you know if there's a specific ending that occurs?
I do not know.
Okay.
I didn't want to ruin it by looking up anything about it.
Yep, makes sense. Anything else that you wanted to bring up, like movies, books, or anything like that? TV?
Nope, that's pretty much it.
All right, sounds good. What about yourself, Kevin?
I've just started. My wife and I started the next season of Manhunter, Mindhunter?
Mindhunter, yep.
Mindhunter. Really
on Netflix,
enjoying it.
It's on Netflix.
Yes, exactly. It's really good. Just as good as the first one. I'm just impressed with the actors that they get to play. You know, some of these people, just how.
Yes.
How they get the son, how the guy that they get to do Son of Sam, and how the guy, you know, for Charlie Manson, it's just their casting is phenomenal. They're very impressive. And like I said, the storyline is really good. Just the continuation and how things are playing with them. I've been really enjoying it. I don't play video games. I really don't. I don't have time actually to play video games. Usually it's when I come home. It's maybe a little bit of dinner, you know, watch Mindhunter, something. But then my wife and I are also training for a marathon. So we've just been doing a lot of running after work and a lot of running on the weekends and things like. And I've just been busy. And like I said, I don't even have a gaming system. You know, I just haven't found the time to actually do that and be able to participate in things.
Any other TV or movies you wanted to bring up?
Started watching that one show on Amazon Prime, the
Carnival something or other?
Yeah, Carnival Row. That's it.
Yep.
I started watching it. I watched a couple episodes. It's all right. I want to continue watching it. There's something that looks Lovecraftian in it, but
yeah, I've watched it as well, and I'm kind of in that same spot where I'm trying to watch a little more to see where it goes.
Yeah,
I really liked it.
Okay, the thing is, it's like I've heard people watch it and they say, oh, it's awful, it's not that great, but then I hear you and they say, oh yeah, it was fantastic. So it sounds like you either really liked it or you really didn't. And
yeah.
So I got to watch it because I'm into steampunk and there's a lot of steampunk elements.
Yep.
To this. And so I figured, all right, well, that in itself is an attraction to me. My wife watched at least one or two episodes and she wasn't too fond of it. So I said, all right, well, let me watch it. And, you know, I'm so far intrigued, but the jury's still out.
All right. Yeah, that's what I've heard. I know you said you liked it, but I've heard a lot of people either liking it or not. It's not, in other words, it's not one of those shows like Mindhunter or whatever that everybody just loves. You know what I'm saying? I guess it's
like Stranger Things.
Yeah, that's an excellent example. Yeah, everybody likes that one. So, but based off of what you said, it seems like you may like it. Abe, you're still trying to figure out, and Barrett, you said you did like it. So
yeah, I enjoyed the heck out of it. I thought it was pretty good.
Very good. Very good. How many episodes is it, Barrett?
I think it's 8.
Okay.
So it's not a huge commitment, you know. It's
right.
Yeah. That's what I like about shows now that are coming out on the streaming services.
Yeah, they're not
you can
like,
watch eight episodes and it's compact. There's no wasted episodes. They get the story out there.
Yeah, they're not like the olden days, like X-Files, where there's like 30 episodes per season type of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I've been on an ongoing listening to horror stories read by this guy named Otis Gyrie. And this one YouTube site called Horror Babble. It's a British guy, and he does a lot of horror stories, but he reads Lovecraft very well.
Now, the first guy you mentioned, where do you find that one? Horror
Otis,
Babble?
Otis Gyrie? You just look him up on YouTube.
Okay, so they're both YouTubers.
Yeah. He's on a lot of stuff on YouTube. Otis Gyrie is also on, he's a regular on this one podcast, Chilling Stories or something, Chilling Stories That Tell in the Dark. I can't.
Oh, yeah, it's on YouTube, yeah.
Yeah, but it's also, for example, there's Horror Babble on iHeart, there's Horror Babble and the Chilling Stories. They both have channels on iHeart.
Gotcha. So they're like almost like podcasts on iHeartRadio.
Yeah, they're yeah.
Gotcha. All right, very good. All right, so let's give our final thoughts on Salem's Lot, the novel. We can start with you, Kevin.
I love this book. I am not a big Stephen King fan. I've said it before. I mean, I've read a couple of his stories. I mean, they're good. I understand his talent. But this book and his short story, Jerusalem's Lot, are two of my favorite stories. They really are. I really love Salem's Lot. And if you want a really good vampire book, you know, a vampire story, this is... You know, the near definitive work for a vampire story. And I know we mentioned it briefly, but there's Jerusalem's Lot. That's a lot more. It the setting is back in the 1700s, and it's more Lovecraftian than it is vampiric.
Speaking of other stories related to that, One for the Road is another King short story, but it takes place after what we see in Salem's Lot and in the winter time where some folks go through the town.
That must be the story I was talking about earlier.
Oh, so besides Jerusalem's Lot, that story.
Yeah. One for the Road. Okay. It was One for the Road. That was the radio drama that I heard.
Gotcha.
And that's the one that's the situation that is kind of mentioned in the epilogue.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So it's like a post, post what we see in Salem's Lot, and I think he wrote it in 77 or 78.
Yeah.
So a couple of years after.
I heard they're going to do a movie based on this book. You know, because a lot of Stephen King movies have been recently doing all right.
Which book?
Salem's Lot. They wanted. They're trying to do
a third
movie, and I was a few times I've actually thought like things that you must have, you know, and I have my own little list of things that you actually must have for
successful
for it to actually be worth watching.
Gotcha. All right, very good. Barrett, what do you got?
I think this is one of the best vampire books out there. Not a lot comes close to it. And it's one of Stephen King's best books as well. I really enjoyed it.
All right, very good. Abe?
It's a solid read. I mean, I think it's one among King's best, especially in terms of his early work. It's a slow burn, but it's a fantastic slow burn. Bouncing ensemble cast very well. With some very subtle scares and just some really good tension. It's a page turner. It's a really solid vampire novel, and definitely one I recommend. I'm glad we got a chance to talk about it today. And if you could find it on the shelves at your local bookstore, I would definitely recommend giving it a read.
All right. It's a solid film. Solid novel. It's an interesting novel too, because it reads very much like a Michael Crichton novel, and yet it doesn't have any science or techno or bio or anything like that in it that a Crichton novel would have. But it has the same setup with the multi characters and ensemble casts, and it also is interesting too because it has like a paid in place type of feel to it as well, because it's talking about the town and the gossip and the interactions between the people and the dirty laundry like affairs and unethical behavior and all that other stuff. So it has a lot of things besides the horror. And then of course it has that small police procedural part that I was mentioning as well with Parker Gillespie. So it could interest a lot of folk, but obviously if you don't like supernatural horror and vampires, then you know, forget about it. But if that doesn't bother you and just like a good read and some of those things like paid in place and Michael Crichton and police procedurals interest you as well, this novel is pretty solid. And then of course what Barrett said too, it's an absolutely phenomenal vampire story. And then I'll say, add to that and be more generic, it's an absolutely awesome horror novel as well. It's pretty solid. We're gonna do another episode of this book in about 3 months, because we're trying to do one every quarter, because it takes a little longer to read novels and especially with busy lives than say just watching a movie and talking about a movie. And if folks want to know what our next topic is going to be, they can email us privately at darkdiscussions@aol.com and ask, because we'll just keep it up as a surprise when we get to it. But I think a lot of folks will be interested, because it is an interesting author or work, I should say, by a specific author that people that would listen to this podcast would like. Let's see. Barrett and Kevin, once again, thanks for joining us here. It's always good to have you guys on.
Happy to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for joining us, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And with that, I guess, Abe, you can lead us out.
All right. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining us to listen to us talk about In the Book of the Book of Salem's Lot. Please join us next time, because we have more book reviews down the road for you all.